You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This episode of the Comedian's Comedian podcast is very proud to be brought to you by James Acaster's Sweet Home Landsteiner Inga, which is a new comedy documentary web series from the people at Turtle Canyon Comedy. Now, you probably already know them. They do loads of stuff with some of the UK's most exciting new comedy talent. People like Harriet Kemsley and Jack Barry, Evelyn Mock, Will Duggan, Mark Smith, and David Trent, of course. They produce all manner of fun bullshit. And I say fun bullshit, they do it to a very high quality, very organised kind of extent. The whole shebang is run by a mysterious triumvirate of people, one of whom I know, Stuart Laws, a brilliant stand-up in his own right. And Turtle Canyon Comedy, you can find them at youtube.com/Turtle Canyon Comedy. But they produce loads and loads of different things. Last year or the year before, they produced Sweet Home Kettering, which was James Acaster going back to his hometown of Kettering. And I'm not going to call it like a spoof documentary or a pseudo or a quasi documentary. It basically is a real documentary. It's just done in an incredibly James Acaster-ish way. And I think that's what Turtle Canyon are really good at doing, is giving people, like working with people to find a platform where they can do their thing in their way. Now, Acaster, as you know, brilliant comic, responsible for some very, very funny stuff. So the episode, series one was called Sweet Home Ketteringa, and series two is called Sweet Home Landsteineringa, where James, in a very James kind of way, dragged a film crew to Germany to visit the twin town of Kettering, the German town of Landstein. So you can find that at youtube.com/Turtle Canyon Comedy, along with lots and lots of other original sketches and series. Now on with the show. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm bringing you an episode with Russell Howard, which I have been wanting to release for a long time, wanting to get Russell on the show for a long time, and we finally done it. We recorded for about 2.5 hours or more, even perhaps. So this is the episode. I'm not splitting it into two. I'm not splitting it into two parts. This is the only part of the episode, but there is an additional 40 or even 50 minutes available to the mailing list. So if you would like to go to comedianscomedian.com/extras and then sign up for the mailing list, if you're not already a member, the process is simple, not too time consuming. It might make you go, oh, for God's sake, but that feeling will pass, and you only need to do it once. And if you're already on the mailing list, you can use your email as your password to download the extras file. There's some really, really good stuff on there. I will tell you more about that shortly. But for now, let's get into a whacking great big chunk of this very, very interesting conversation with Russell Howard.
You kind of know that everyone on the circuit is listening to this right now, so hello.
And does that make you nervous? Because I feel like you to be slightly convinced into doing it. Is that fair to say?
Just I was convinced into doing it because I was worried that I'd be too boring, or if it was in front of, see, I'm denied about doing it in front of a live crowd because I'm such a whore for laughter. There's no way, like me, Olver and John Richardson did a similar thing.
Yes,
I think a few years ago. And I was just, and it was meant to be like this in-depth chat, and it just descended into kind of a piss take.
I think I might have seen that, but that was Oliver's show, Dancing About Architecture.
Yeah, yeah. So Oliver had these really grandiose ideas about, you know, the kind of nature of comedy and where it comes from.
It's a much better title than mine. It's much more literary.
Yeah, but I spent a lot of, because when I met John, he handed me a banana. And that was the first time we met when we were kids. And I took the piss out of him for doing that. And yeah, we didn't really go anywhere as far as comedy is concerned. But I just chatted about this weird northern
banana
kid.
Anecdote.
Yeah, but I did. I remembered him as like a young kid that was kind of going, "Do you want a banana?"
I didn't know that you knew each other as kids.
Well, I was like 20.
Teenage comics. Or
yeah,
late
yeah,
teenage.
Yeah. 23 when I met him, yeah. And because he was at Bristol Uni. But we sort of knew him as like the weird kid that would hand fruit to people. So that was, you know, that was where I went with it. Which, of course, he wasn't. He was a brilliant comic, but I took the piss and said he was getting gigs because he was giving people mangoes and that. So, yeah, Oliver was slightly annoyed at me.
So where are you now? Where do we find you in comedy at the moment? You said you've been doing loads of PR yesterday, loads of promo stuff. Is that for Stand Up Central?
Yeah, yeah. So I just did some interviews yesterday to promote that, and I am just about to go on a tour, like a travel show with my mum. Of America, and then after that I'm getting ready for my tour.
Okay.
Of my proper tour, which is in 2017.
So that's the next, that's Wonderbox is concluded.
All done, yeah. All done ages ago, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So this is and so I currently have nothing for the show because I kind of spent the last 2 months writing stuff for Comedy Central, uh-huh. And now that's gone, so now I've got to start again. So,
well, talk to me about
so
that.
So I currently have nothing.
Well, this is it.
I lost it all in a week. It was so weird. It was so, you spend 2 months and you kind of, I was gigging every night, I was writing every day, and I was kind of really felt good and really enjoyed stand-up, was really loving it. And then you just see it all go in a week, and then you're like, ah, oh, fuck, I've got to do it again.
Is there any... Like, when the show goes out, will the director say, or will the producer say, we didn't use that bit, you've still got that? Or are you interested in using anything?
I have the edit, so I've already had that. So there's a couple of bits, there's maybe about 5 minutes that I can save, but they were kind of 5 minutes that weren't really good enough. Okay. So that's why they were cut. So
yeah.
Yeah. So
but presumably if they weren't good enough now, by 2017 they could be good enough if there's a kernel or something.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. There's definitely one bit that I think is kind of interesting. I just couldn't quite get... Actually, it's not that it didn't work. It just didn't work on TV.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting thing where sort of when you watch it back, certain things leap out and certain things just seem kind of baggy. And particularly I'm only doing like 5 minutes at the top, which... So you... approaching Comedy Central, you have to do there's 10 episodes and I've got to do 10 fives, mm-hmm. So I have to kind of write singles rather than an album,
yeah.
So it's kind of weird, so you have to make it go from 0 to 60 as quick as possible and kind of resolve itself, and certain bits in a kind of an hour and a half set are really nice and you kind of go, so now I'm going to talk about this, and it feels,
yes.
But from starting they suddenly look quite kind of boring and flabby, yeah. Is the way, so you just kind of, okay, cut that, move that.
Sure. So I did, funnily enough, I was talking, having been on the show the other week.
Yes, did very well.
And thank you. And having talked about the process like before, and I put a bit on this podcast of, yeah. Like, right, this is what I'm thinking about so-and-so, and I did a little kind of audio diary afterwards as
oh,
well.
Oh, okay.
Like, case in point, I did that stuff about dementia.
Yes.
And that stuff is not, you would not open a show with that.
Yes.
You know, it's like, it's exactly that. It's like, here's five really interesting, funny, kind of bittersweet minutes.
Yes.
Which actually aren't, they're not really a calling card, and they're certainly not an opening five. So is that sort of similar to what you mean? You've got like a five, I don't mean about my stuff, but I've been, I mean...
Well, no, I mean exactly that, but then the problem I have to then do is I have to introduce the night, I have to explain the concept, and then I have to sort of get into something, but not talk to the crowd, because that always looks awful on TV.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of suddenly go, so let's talk about... Whereas, and it's very different from Good News, you have the news. So you can kind of go, so what's been happening?
And then so that's half a sentence, isn't it? And then we're...
Completely, and we have a clip that explains what's happening, and then I'm funny off the clip. So it's... You sort of don't... I didn't realise how easily digestible Good News is in comparison to stand-up, because you have to say, so here's what I've been thinking about, and here are my jokes on this subject. Do you understand the subject?
Yeah.
Like it really, for TV, it's a very different thing, whereas if you're in a live room, you can just, you know, you can have a chat with someone in the front row, you can get things going, you can sort of, so that after 10 minutes you're cooking and everything, you've set up a few things in the room, you've established you're funny with a bit of kind of witter about you know, the local area or whatever, or some guy in the front row said something, or it's been and you're there, but you kind of can't do that on stand up on TV, because you have to convince the people instantly sat on the sofa not to turn over. So hello, don't, so let's get going.
Yes.
So it has to kind of start like that.
And you are pretty far from being a one-liner comic.
Yes.
So in your kind of origin in comedy, you were, so did someone,
my, I think, origin,
your origin. This, so I think someone said, I didn't know this, but did you start off purely improvising?
Or is that a bum steer? No. I started when I was 18, and I I've been writing jokes from the age of 15, when I was 17, I thought, I'm going to do it. And I went to Jester's in Bristol, which is now a Tesco Metro. And I
destroyed that building.
I went there and I had pages of jokes and that I'd written. And I went on a Saturday afternoon. I just rocked up and knocked on the door. And it took so much courage to kind of go, I'll do the gig tonight. I didn't realise. I had no idea that obviously that wasn't going to happen. And they went, "Well, you can't." And I went, "Well, I'm here." And they kind of went, "Well, you know, there was a guy actually that said, 'Oh, there's an open spot circuit and look for that.'" And I was like, "Oh, okay." So then I kind of found out about.
Well, trying to pretend you knew about that.
I didn't know.
You mean open spots? Yes, yeah. Of course. Yeah.
But I thought you know, I'd sort of made the decision to do it, and then so I got the bus home, slightly disappointed. And then went to a comedy club in Bristol that's now defunct as well. It was called Virgin Mirth, and I watched it. And there was a man eating a spoon with a banana, and he was singing the theme tune to The Sweeney. And it was kind of like the tail end of kind of alternative comedy. Do you know what I mean? So it was sort of 1998. This is, and there were these kind of wild, strange guys. And I sort of watched it and thought, I can't be this bad. Surely I'll be okay. And then kind of went on, did it the next week. And then for about 6 months had kind of material that was, I can't even remember. It was very kind of, you know, wishy-washy, very kind of, I said this bit about like, oh, how did Captain Kirk get through the Star Trek episodes without flicking Spock's ears? Like, so the kind of,
okay.
And then I'd react if people laughed. Oh, that's an interesting laugh. And naturally, after 6 months, I'd seen Ross Noble, I'd seen Phil Kay, I'd seen Justin Lee Collins, who used to do loads of improv, and I just ditched material. So I didn't do anything. I had no material for the next, probably 3 years. So when I did Totally Funny, it was in the semi-final, it was completely improvised. I went on and kissed the baby and kind of just riffed with the front row and was so at ease doing that. I just found it so much simpler,
yes,
than writing jokes. And then about, I don't know, maybe it's when I was about 22, I kind of started, I felt like I could perform, and then I began to learn how to write comedy.
So if you think funny, improvised and got through the semis,
mm-hmm,
and the thing they always say to you in that competition is, do your stuff again at the final.
Yeah, yeah. I had nothing, yeah.
You had nothing. So how did the final go? I don't remember your
final
win.
No.
I was
in with Jimmy Carr, and I'd met Jimmy the day previously, and he looked me up and down. This is the first time we met. He looked me up and down and went, my God, I bet you've been on a lot of caravanning holidays. And he was right. And Josie was in it, Josie Long. David O'Doherty was in it. A comedian called Eric Petrosian. Juliet Cowan. Andy Zaltzman.
Yeah.
And I forget the others. And it went really well, actually. I think because I was a kid, so I was, and I looked really young. So I was 18, and I was super excited to be there. So I kind of think they kind of laughed, oh, isn't he nice, type thing.
Yeah.
And I kind of spoke about the festival. And I remember the day of the final, I saw a guy dragging a toilet down the Royal Mile, and he was painted blue, and it made me laugh, and that was what my set was about. And it was like this kind of, only in Edinburgh, Christ, you imagine doing that in the, so it was, yeah. I basically did a bit of local that I'd seen in the day for the final, and it was quite funny. So
when you say like, imagine that, that's kind of like a comedy trope, isn't it? Take an idea and go, I saw it in this context, imagine that in that context.
Yeah, yeah.
So were you, when you were riffing, were you sort of naturally discovering those sorts of techniques to go, you know, imagine if aliens saw this concept, what they'd make of it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess so. I've never really thought about it, but I was just, you know, 18 and just instinctively doing whatever, like, it just, that's what struck me in that moment. You would never see that in the high street in Bristol, and yet here it was fine, you know. So yeah, I guess I kind of stumbled upon, you know, kind of tricks, and yeah, that was it, really.
So that period, I just want to stay with that period for a moment, of like two or three years of turning up to gigs. I mean, that must have been...
It was brilliant.
I mean, it must have been great, because you don't have to worry about writing anything. Like, the whole point of this show is, Jesus, there's a blank page, what do I do?
But also, I was at university, and it was just great. So I'd just rock up, and I'd just kind of go at it. And I'd seen Phil Kay, and I'd seen Ross.
That's a great pedigree, the thing.
Well, exactly. And so I was very lucky when I was... how old was I? I was 19, and I got to support Phil Kay on tour. Me and James Dowdwell supported him on tour. And it was incredible. So I did 10 gigs with him. I was getting 50 quid a gig, and it was amazing. And I basically took a week off university to do it. And it was an incredible apprenticeship, because you sort of saw him do stuff. He was so fearless. And it was so interesting to me as a incredibly normal, boring, bland young man to go, oh my, you can be anyone. They don't know who you are. You can just leap into the room and just be mad and be wild. So I had a real sort of fixation on, I like dyed my hair blue. And I just kind of wanted to be incredible. You know, I was a kid, I was like 19, and I just wanted to be different and not of this earth, and just kind of, no, I didn't want to do material. I want to just, you know, I used to like walk on tables and kind of go through people's drinks and, do you know what I mean? It's a complete rip-off, a poor rip-off of what...
Do you mean go through their bags and take their drinks?
All that kind of
go
stuff.
Go through their drinks.
Sorry, what did I say? I meant, as in, whatever they had on the table. But, you know, I was just kind of relentlessly trying to be kind of mad and weird.
So were you aware when you did So You Think You're Funny and you're up against... I mean, there couldn't be a comic that's more the opposite of that than Jimmy.
Yeah.
So when you stood in that back room, the scary back room in the Gilded Hall, you know, Gilded Balloon debating hall.
The best thing about that back room bit is that Zaltzman, Andy went on first, and then I think Josie was on second, and then it was me. And in the space of that, and we were only doing like 5 minutes, Zaltzman was shit-faced by the time we got back. And it was just like, I was like, how have you got drunk that quickly?
But you must have been aware, like, hang on, I'm the only person here who's planning to go out there and make up everything.
But I wasn't, because I had a bit of stuff about the toilet.
Oh, okay. So that, well, yeah, you had.
So in that instance, I was going to chat about that, and I think I had one other bit, but then I had 3 minutes to fill. So do you know what I mean?
Okay. So you've got some ideas, some concepts in your back pocket of like, I'll probably talk about the toilet guy.
Yeah.
I'll probably talk about something else. The rest will just come.
Yeah, yeah. But just the madness of youth, right? It's just like, so Thierry Henry says that you're not frightened of taking a penalty when you're 18 because you've never missed. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly how I felt. I mean, I'd never dream of doing that now. You know, of like going on, like, imagine doing Jimmy Fallon and going, I'll wing it for three. But
it's sort of the same, isn't it? In terms of the...
I'd never missed before, so I wasn't going to miss.
Yeah.
So it was fine. So I wasn't kind of nervous because, you know...
So what I'd seen was a guy the with first a toilet. Time... What was the first time you did miss when you went on with nothing, planned to like, I'm just gonna wing this? Presumably at some point, it didn't fire.
It always kind of worked. I kind of got bored of it, like genuinely, because if you're amiable enough, you can always create something. Like, you're not going to storm a gig all the time. Sometimes you will. Sometimes it's just a bit. I mean, you can always get by going, oh, he was just the random guy. Do you know what I mean? So,
yes.
So
okay.
You, even though you're not getting laughs, it's not going to be... it's not going to be terrible because you're always engaging them. So if it's a room full of 30 people and you're chatting to some guy and it kind of doesn't go somewhere, but it sort of does, it's always going to be all right. So I think it was kind of cowardice on my part to not come up with stuff. And then, like I said, when I got to about 22, I reckon, I kind of just got bored of just badgering people and wanted to try and see if I could write stuff.
So what was the first routine that you remember writing from that period?
I wrote a routine that it was, I read a story, there was a guy in, I think, South Africa who, two guys that had been thrown off a plane in South Africa because they refused to stop kissing
yes.
each other.
And you did, you went, I saw this, you did this on Conan.
Yes.
Yes, I know the routine. Yeah.
And it was, and that was the first sort of bit that I did. And so I basically just, like, I can't remember exactly, it was, I'd love to have been on that flight, just seeing them, mwah, 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 and just some guy shouting out, stop doing that, it's not natural. And then the guy turns around and goes, you're flying.
Yeah.
And they kind of carry on kissing. And it just got such a big laugh. And it was that great thing where you went, oh, okay, can do it. And then I kind of really got into kind of trying to write stuff. But writing I found a lot harder than I did performing. Performing came... kind of, oh, I sound like such a tip, but it came relatively...
This is the moment I was talking about.
Okay.
This is exactly the right talk about it.
But it sort of came relatively easily to me. And we always had to turn stuff over in Bristol because we didn't have an audience. There was probably about 50 people that used to come. A lot of jugglers used to come and watch us. So it was around this period. It was amazing for our development. Sort of like me over... Will Hodgson and John Richardson, every week we used to do a gig, sort of from about, like, this is when I took comedy really seriously. I wasn't really taking it seriously when I was at university, so I was improvising, I was getting a degree, I was dicking about on stage, and then I kind of thought, I want to do this. And then every Sunday we would do The Bunch of Grapes, new material, all of us would do that. Then on the Tuesday we'd do a little gig called the Richmond Springs where we'd hone the stuff we'd done on the Sunday. Then on the Wednesday we did a student night at Jester's and we'd do the open spot in the middle and smash the guts out of it. And then we'd do it again on the Sunday, Tuesday. And for about a sort of 2-3 year period, give or take, you know, gigs that came up, that was our cycle. And there was such a small pool of people that came to watch comedy in Bristol that we had to kind of come up with stuff.
It's a force to discipline on you.
It was amazing. So by the time I kind of sort of migrated and came to London, I never had like an iron tight five, but I had kind of, I was comfortable talking for like half an hour. I was comfortable and I could, you know, I had confidence in myself to kind of go, I'll do that bit or I'll do this bit. You know.
So that process of trying the thing on this, like writing it, doing it on the Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and then refining it, when you were writing it, what did that look like? Because I remember gigging with you years ago in Boston, in Lincolnshire Uni.
Yeah.
Uni, it wasn't in Boston. And I remember you having a great big sort of A4,
yeah.
one of those spiral notebooks.
Still got them,
with
yeah.
just joke, like that. And you were looking through it beforehand. I think I was emceeing, you were closing. You were looking through it going, what did I do here last time? What did
yeah.
I do here last time? I remember even then being like, wow, this guy's got a work ethic.
Yeah. Well,
Sorry, go on.
What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that the process of putting the, roughing out the potential ideas to then go and try them on the Sunday night. What sorts of things, when you talked before about things jumping out,
yeah.
what sorts of subject? Was that the kind of the beginnings of the stuff about your family? Was it the beginnings of stuff about topical stuff? Were you trying to do news stories?
It was kind of a hodgepodge of anything, really. It was just that, where else was I going to go on a Sunday? That was kind of where I went. So it's where we all went. And me and Olver and kind of John and Dowdswell and Hodge would kind of push each other along. So you kind of... I don't know. Like mostly it was on the road stuff, I think. You know, so it's like, oh, I was in such and such. And, you know, and something happened. So it was very... lots of shaggy stories.
And anecdotal rather than...
Yeah, completely.
Jokes.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. I've never really... You know, and we kind of write it on stage. So you go, okay, this happened, and you just go, bwah, on the Sunday. Mm-hmm. And then you go, okay, that's quite cool, and I'll do that again. And then you'd sort of slightly refine it on the Tuesday, and on the Wednesday would be a little bit better. So it was very much work in progress on stage. That's kind of how, certainly how I wrote, definitely how Olva writes. I don't know about if that's what John was doing at the time, but I know a lot of it was us talking out stuff that, and we pushed each other along because we're all pretty decent and we kind of encouraged each other to sort of just go for it rather than, and also it was the same crowd, so you just couldn't,
you couldn't fall back.
You couldn't do, oh, I went on holiday recently and a thing happened. Oh yeah, we know. And it was the same with Lincoln. I used to do that. I went through a stage of, I kind of compared it once a month, and I always had, I would sort of banter with the crowd, but then I'd have new stuff and I'd really try and wallop that gig. And then a month later, I'd go, right, okay, so all these little gigs built up to that, and I'd banter with the crowd and I'd have new stuff and I'd try and wallop that. So I kind of had like this weird following in like Lincoln.
Yeah, I remember like, being told that at the time.
Or like,
yeah.
Or like Worcester, or gigs that I'd been to loads and kind of had turned stuff over. And you heard these sort of the stories of Frank Skinner traveling around the five gigs,
yes,
around the country.
Yeah,
and I really loved that. And I did exactly the same with the Comedy Network, that every year the Comedy Network, you'd have gigs in universities. Every single year I would go and I would have a new, I was so lucky, I supported John Oliver, mm-hmm, around universities, and then I also supported Daniel Kitson around universities, so, and you sort of learnt from them that they would turn their material over as they went throughout the tour. And the following year when you went back to that gig, you had to have new stuff, you had to have a new, so I would have a new half an hour every single year I went back to those, because that's what he did, because that's what John Oliver did and that's what Kitson did, and I wanted to be as good as them, so
yeah,
you have to try, you know. And it would kind of like, I was so lucky that the people that I kind of hung around with and were my mates were kind of like gods, you know. And like,
yeah,
sort of hanging out with Daniel, you know, and sort of touring with him. I mean, is there a better apprenticeship for a young comic in the world? There isn't.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I'd see him.
And he didn't really tour with, I think you're the only person who sort of did that with,
yeah,
him.
It was, I guess he did stuff with Gavin. He does,
oh, yeah,
stuff with,
sure,
Gav. But I can remember, so when we used to do those uni gigs, we did two years of those tours. Stuff would happen to him during the day, right? And I would see it happen, and it was something, but it kind of wasn't. And I would see him go on stage and turn it into, like, this fantastic anecdotal comedy. And, you're like, holy shit, I was there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that good.
Yeah.
How has he made it this good so quickly? And it was just incredible just to watch him. And like, I remember he did a gig at the Glee once. He was just pulling stuff out of his pockets, chatting about it. He was just getting himself comfy under the gig. And it was just, yeah, it was incredible. So I think I was very lucky to work and be pals with geniuses who have an insane work ethic. So not being a genius, you kind of go, well, I'm going to have to work. I'm going to have to work like 10 times harder than those people.
So this is Russell. I properly came away from this interview feeling like, oh, this is the best one. This is the best podcast. I think the dynamic between Russell's outward face, his persona as being so bubbly and energetic, and also kind of, you know, I mean, untouchably famous. And the kind of the dynamic between that apparent self and the self that we're getting in this interview, I think is absolutely fascinating. And I really respect and appreciate Russell's candour and him kind of submitting to this process. That sounds awful, submitting to the process, but you know what I mean. I think I learnt a lot from this. I really did. I think along the way, I'm not going to say journey, but the last few years of doing this podcast, I feel like there are certain key interviews from which I've walked away thinking, not just I've got a lot out of it, but I've really learnt a lot. And not just about a person, I've learnt something about the way we all bring ourselves to this and what we all want out of it. And I really enjoyed this one. Listening back to it has been really I mean, I can't talk about it. Obviously, I'm partly responsible for it, so it would be quite wrong for me to further prolong us getting back into it by talking about how much I liked it. But guys, I really liked this one. Had two really exciting interviews today as well with Shappi Korsandi and Wendy Wason. Both of those will be coming up soon, so stay tuned for those. Do subscribe to the show, by the way. I think more of you are subscribing. I don't know if some of you will be casual listeners, but you may as well just chuck it on your podcast app and click subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from, because that's just useful for me to know how many people get it automatically. And I find the shows to which I subscribe, the ones that pop up on my phone, they're the ones. There's a lot of podcasts out there, and I think the ones I listen to and go, oh yes, there's that, oh yep, there's that, there's, you know, it makes it a lot more easy to deal with. So by all means, subscribe. By all means, chuck a review at us, or indeed some money. Thank you, everyone, for your donations. I'm not going to ring the bell particularly hard on this episode, but if you're new to the show, if you're one of Russell's fans and you're not familiar with the rest of these shows, then there are 169 other episodes waiting out there for you. They're all free. And if you find that you are enjoying them, then there has never been a better time to go to comedianscomedian.com/donate and send me either a one-off or a recurring donation in support of the show if you feel it's making a difference to your life or your practice and it's making you feel good about any of those things or feel good about creativity in general. I've been getting some just brilliant emails from people recently. There's been a real lot of people. I am absolutely exhausted, and if you choose to stick around for the waffle at the end of this show, I will explain why. If you don't, please just bear with me. There's been a lot of people getting in touch to talk about how this show has inspired them. I'm so tired. I've got to go do a preview, an hour preview, and then at midnight drive for 2 hours. I'm so tired. I'm sure I'll be fine. I'll take regular breaks. I won't just rely on coffee. I'll be fine. My point is, a lot of people have been telling me recently how much they are finding the show to be an inspiration, and I'm very proud to hear it. Thank you. So if you're one of those people who's told me that, I do get back to everyone, but I can never quite say in an email, particularly when I'm hacking through admin with my both eyes half closed, I can never quite say as much as I would like to say. As much as I can say now, you can hear it in my voice. I'm genuinely touched. I really appreciate it when people let me know that this show's making a difference. So if you're one of them, thank you. And if you're one of them who hasn't told me, by all means, tell me through the medium of an email to info@comedianscomedian.com, a simple tweet to @comcompod, or indeed the medium of money. You could do that too. If you're on the mailing list, I'll get in touch with you soon. I've got a lot of previews coming up throughout July. You can join the Facebook group at you can just find Comedians Comedian on Facebook and join the private group through which you can occasionally get in touch with me and the rest of the burgeoning Facebook Comedians Comedian community. There's lots of people now. There's enough people now that occasionally some people are a bit chippy. That's quite interesting. But I'm pleased to say the vast majority of you are using it in a useful way to help me devise interviews, to help me devise questions, to let me know the questions you would like me to ask. I'm also going to be at a couple of festivals. For the first time, I'm doing the Llama and Latitude Festival Double Up Weekender, which means on the Saturday I drive an unbelievable distance to a British comedian, if not an Australian, to get from the brilliant Llama Tree Festival to the equally brilliant Latitude Festival. So if you're going to be at either one of those, you can come along and see me interviewing Tiffany Stevenson at Llama Tree and performing in the Comedy Arena at Sunday lunchtime at Latitude. So I hope to see you there. And the last little plug before we get back to Russell is my Edinburgh show, my Edinburgh Fringe show this year. It's called Compared to What. I'm very proud of it. I had a tough preview last week, and this week I'm pleased to say I've had two more, much more pleasant ones, and hopefully a third coming in tonight. I'm really enjoying it. I'll tell you more about it later, but all you need to know is it's a free show, but do bring money, and it's at 3:45 p.m. daily on the Liquid Rooms Annex. That's part of PBH's Free Fringe, and if you see any PBH fundraisers coming up soon, then please go along to those. I'm doing one in Angel on the somethingth of July. the 10th of July. I'll tell you more about that when we get nearer the time. And also, I've got a couple of previews coming up. I'm going to be at ARG at 5 o'clock on the Sunday, if you know what ARG is. And if you have kids and you would like them to see me do some stand-up for kids, which I bloody love doing, and I'm pleased to say that I have a bit of a natural facility for, I will be at the Udderbelly on the South Bank in London on Sunday, the 3rd of July, lunchtime. I think it's something like 1 or 2 o'clock. Check that out. There's me and a couple of other acts doing that. It'll bound to be a lot of fun. That's all the things I wanted to tell you. Is it? There was one final plug. What was the last thing? No, that was it. That was the Edinburgh show. Great. More chat later after the episode if you'd like it. And remember, you can get the extras. You can get the extra 40 or 50 minutes of this episode. There's some really good gear there. All sorts of stuff that we get into about a time Russell teared up when he was presented with a fan reaction, an older lady fan reaction to the show, and exactly what that means to him, as well as he talks a bit more about his comedy influences. And indeed, we get stuck into, there's a really good section on there's a lesson we can learn from Coldplay, question mark, exclamation mark. And we also talk about the kind of the way that someone's credentials with the critics can change over time. So there's lots of good stuff there. Oh, yeah. And the main thing that we talk about is I really challenge Russell about the representation of true events in his material. So do grab that from comedianscomedian.com/extras. Now let's get back to Russell Howard.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
I think the first bit of stand-up I ever saw Daniel do, or the first bit that I remember, was about the clams. You got these clams at Borough Market, which he's seen on a TV programme that you're supposed to cook them live.
Yeah.
And he did a little act out of these clams being cooked, going, I think if I had my time over, I'd have told her how I felt.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and he would sort of imbue.
Yeah.
We're talking about him like he's dead. He is to me. we had that. We would... he would imbue... Like, his act-outs would have a kind of real humanity in them.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's had an influence on you as well, in that your angle seems to me to be moments of joy, moments of happiness. Your angle is celebration. Like, very rarely do we have a Russell Howard routine that is... I mean, more recently, there is a lot more anger coming out, which I think is fascinating, which we will talk about. But yeah. I think in the stuff that you started to be known for,
yeah,
your stock in trade was celebrating moments of joy.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of... sort of a moment that really summed up, me and my friend Al Pitcher were talking about this, that I remember both of us stood at a train station watching somebody run like buggery to get on a train, just and they made it, and we both felt great, and really, really, it was like, oh, it really cheered me up. And I think there's a lot of comics who would kind of would be delighted that they didn't make the train.
Yeah,
but I like it when people make the train, and that's always been something that's kind of cheered me up. I like I find still now, like, little bits. Like, it can be wonderful. Things can be so glorious and so beautiful about existence. And I quite like celebrating those things. Like, that sounds so wanky. But you know what I mean? Like, I genuinely, I just find it easier because there's things that cheer me up. And also, fundamentally, when I do stand-up, it's the happiest I am. It's so... I mean, obviously, I'm not like that all the time, but there is nothing... like performing to people, telling them jokes, making them laugh, and them laughing at you. So if you can't be happy in that moment, like, I just would never be able to kind of put on an act. But I'm so delighted that there are people there laughing at me that it's, you know, it's just incredible. So I think that's it. I'm kind of, I was certainly at the beginning, I was so kind of buoyant and excited that I just, I don't know, I'm rambling now, but
you're not at all.
But you know, I just found, I don't know. I think those things are more interesting for me, and it also like the, it was a big break for you. I did a show in 2006 where I was nominated for the Perrier, and my brother nearly died that year because he had and this was like a big part of the show. He had an epileptic fit, and he's got epilepsy. And basically, we had to put, short story, we had to put Valium up his arse on Christmas Day. And yeah, he was like kind of, you know, he was having this horrific fit. We had to kind of put Valium up. And he was kind of, how old was he? So he's 24. So he was naked. And it was a big part of the show. And it was kind of, And I didn't even mean to do it like this, but so as a consequence, the whole show became a, oh, let's look on the bright side. My brother nearly died, you know, let's not dwell on that. And I had like loads of kind of little tidbits of stuff that I enjoyed, be it somebody, I think I had an old bit about, I can't remember any of my stuff, but I had a bit about a train announcer, having a go at some kids from Swindon who were throwing pebbles at the train, and he called them cunts. And it was just, and the whole train just cheered. It was amazing. So everything seemed to fit, but what gave it the ballast was this sort of story about my brother nearly dying.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's kind of how I constructed stuff.
I think most comics would go, it's easier to bring down the king than it is to celebrate the little guy in order to generate laughs. But you seem more inclined to celebrate the little guy.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if you found that easier, if it's just that it makes you happier to do it, so you worked harder so you could do it.
I don't know. It's kind of weird, isn't it, when you sort of talk about what you do. I've never really questioned it. It's just, it's... particularly when I was younger, there weren't many things that I was very kind of happy-go-lucky. I was incredibly excited and delighted to be doing gigs, so I didn't really have anything to be upset about. But
were you happy-go-lucky before you started doing gigs? Were gigs the thing that made you happy from a...
Completely. It changed my life. It was in, like, when I found comedy, I kind of... I've said this before, and this is definitely the corniest thing you'll hear me ever say. But have you ever seen the film Interview with a Vampire?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Have you heard me say this before?
No.
So, you know when Brad Pitt gets bitten?
Yeah.
And then he wakes up and he's now a vampire and his eyes are different.
Yeah.
And he sees the world in a different way. That is genuinely how I felt the day after I did my first gig. I sort of like, it feels like, and I think we all feel this, that you suddenly go, I found a mechanism through which I can do life.
Yeah.
I found something that makes everything worthwhile. Like, I can put everything I see or do or think or feel through this thing. This is going to be wonderful. And that, genuinely, that's how I felt. So, you know, when I was 18, kind of, I was so delighted to be doing stand-up, and I was dicking around with crowds and so happy to get laughs and be different and not just be this kind of person that was ignored in nightclubs by girls, that suddenly you're like, I'm a comedian, you know. So it was that desire to be, I just felt like I found something and I kind of knew I could do it, and it just changed everything.
I think a lot of people listening to this are really going to either empathise with that moment to go, absolutely, it does feel like that.
Yeah.
Or if they're not comedians and they want to be, they're going to go, bollocks, I'm going to do it, you know, yeah. Because they'll be jealous of that moment. But I suppose what I'm getting at is, if you went through this transformation and became happy, does that suggest that pre-discovering comedy, you weren't that happy a kid?
It was sort of weird. There was like, I was very good at football. That was my thing. And I was kind of, and then I had a few things happen at school when I was 15, and it meant that I kind of didn't. I sort of lost all my friends and had to kind of find new friends.
Can you? I don't want to prompt.
Nah, it's not. It's not worth. It's pretty. Okay, it's fine. Pretty grisly. But I can't. Anyways, you know. So
so something negative happened.
So
spoiled your plans.
Yeah, well, it changed me in a different career path from being kind of a jock, I guess, to hanging out with the freaks and geeks. And weirdly, one of my friend Craig gave us, he found a Lee Evans video that his dad had got, and we watched it and it changed our life. And then me and Craig used to kind of watch this, and I get all of Lee Evans's videos, and we kind of watch it every Christmas. That was a thing. And I kind of made my way through all these kind of albums and stuff. And that I could, this sounds incredibly deep and I don't mean it to, but I kind of knew that could be, I had real dreams. I kind of lived in a small town and I had dreams and aspirations that could be, doing comedy could be my escape from normality. And I could hopefully kind of travel the world, you know. And I think that's what we all feel, is that when you get hold of this thing, you suddenly go, oh my God, this is great. And I remember, like, my first five gigs were great. They were amazing. Really, really got huge laughs. It was really fantastic. And then my sixth gig was awful, like properly died. I was on with Scott Capurro and Paul B. Edwards. And I said to Scott, and I was like completely broken. I was like, oh my God, what do you do after a bad gig? And Scott's like, I like to get a cock in my mouth as soon as possible, like that. And I was like, I'm not sure if I'm willing to do, but is that what you have to do? But I remember walking home that night broken, like my, you know, I feel like this was my path and it's now gone. And then something kicked in where you're going to go, I'm going to have to work a lot harder because that can't happen again. That cannot happen. I can't feel like this. So the only way around this is to work harder. And you're like, yes, Russell, we will. And it was just kind of weird conversation with yourself. And that, because otherwise, you know, what are we going to do? We're just going to have a rubbish job. We're going to hate our lives. So we have to work harder. So that was it. So I've always had this kind of weird, like, yeah, I don't know. I'm rambling now.
You're not.
No, I am.
You're not. What you're doing is you're revealing a bit of something that you're maybe not happy about revealing.
Okay.
Is that, and that's why you're telling yourself you're rambling?
Yeah,
well, think?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's like...
I can really relate to that. I think a lot of people listening to this can. First moment when I went, oh, this changes everything, was followed immediately. It was parallel with the thought is, thank fuck for that. Because I didn't like where this was going. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, that's really funny. You don't see that. That'd be a really great scene in a film where the hero kind of goes, this is it. This changes everything. About fucking time, brain, you piece of shit. Where have you been lurking? And then you instantly get angry at yourself.
But it's a rope ladder from a helicopter, isn't it? It's like for me, it was busking. You know, it was the first time I did a street show, came away with 30 quid and a hat, looked at my mate who'd done this show, and we just went, this changes everything. Yeah. It felt like a secret door in the universe. Yeah. Through here.
But it is actually a secret world because you, like, when I was a kid, the stuff on TV, this is pre-internet, YouTube, anything like that. It was Harry Enfield and it was The Fast Show, both of which I loved. It was Bottom, it was Shooting Stars, you know, and I used to watch If I Got News For You with my dad, and I was like, I'd loved it. And I used to see the way that Paul Merton made my dad laugh, and we'd all be howling as a family, and you're like, oh, I want some of this. And I used to collect, there used to be Paramount, used to have like a late night stand up show. I think it was The Comedy Store, they used to have that. So I used to watch that. Gas. Which was on Channel 4, used to watch that.
I totally forgot about Gas. Yeah.
Edinburgh Bust used to record all these things, and I used to watch all of them and loved it.
Just for Laughs, Montreal, and then they used to show you, I saw Eddie Izzard doing the Wolves bit. German guy doing the thing about backpacking.
That's it.
All of that stuff I heard.
So you see all this, and you go, oh God, they're all amazing. And then as soon as you do comedy, you suddenly go, what this. So pubs, you go, oh yeah, and I know that's called the Hope and Anchor, but on Thursdays it's the Giggle Hut.
Yeah.
And you suddenly realise that there's pubs all over the country that have gigs, and you suddenly go, what, I can do...
It's just there.
There's a gig in Plymouth called Club Fandango. Yeah, of course. Like, that Jeff Whiting, that was my third ever... No, it was my fifth gig, and I travelled to Club Fandango in Plymouth from Bristol, 6-hour round journey. Yeah. Did 5 minutes. It was great. I've never, you know, it was that feeling. I went with my little brother and we were just high as a kite. It was incredible. We've been to Plymouth and we've just done a gig. and it went amazing. And we had a McDonald's on the way home. It was just glorious. So that's what I loved about it. It was suddenly a reason. It gave you a reason to get out of the house and just go for it. And I kind of I loved it, and I still love it. That's what that's the interesting thing about stand up now, is that if I have a new idea and I get it going, it's amazing, isn't it? It doesn't matter what you've done. There is nothing that competes with, I tell you what, that's going to be all right.
Yeah.
It needs a few more goes, but that there's something in that. And yeah. I think the moment that you don't have that, fucking, I've got a new bit, that's when you've kind of got to stop. But do you know what I mean? Like, it's
absolutely.
That, because I think that's what connects all of us, that you kind of, if you've got a new bit, you're like, fucking hell. And I bet you Billy Connolly's still like that. I bet you money. I bet you he's got a little bit. I saw him at the Hammersmith Apollo, and I was bet there's bits in that he's like, fucking love doing that bit. That's my bit I want to do. That really works, but I really like that.
You've reminded me of something that I have to thank you for, which I hadn't put on my notes. I completely forgot until now. This is something I think very often. I think it's a thing Alan Cochran told me that you said years ago. I'm going to make it out.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And there's a twinkle on your eye there, like, oh, shit.
Well, it could be Vince. Anything. Yeah, yeah. yeah. I mean, what an amazing comic Cochran is. I remember seeing him in Edinburgh. I think it was 2007. It's still one of the best Edinburgh shows I've ever seen. It was fucking incredible.
Was that the one with the bell?
Yeah.
My favourite words in my...
No. Sorry. It was the one he did at The Stand. And it was just an hour of brilliant stand-up, brilliant observational stand-up, just left to centre. And I was just kind of just blown away. I think he's amazing. But anyways, what did I say to him?
So apparently you said to him, and then he repeated to me during... I mean, I'm an emotional roller coaster, yeah. Even without stand-up in my life.
Yeah, what did I say?
He said...
Do you want to fight, Gippo?
he said, well, what Russell told me, what Russell always says, is that comedy's brilliant because every time you think to yourself, I hate this, I'm not feeling it at all,
yeah.
You know that in a month, I think it might be 3 months, you know that on the other end of the wave, you'll be absolutely loving it again.
Yeah.
That has got me through an awful lot of times when I've gone, what am I doing? My secret door appears to be shrinking and going away from me. I'm going to have to live in the real world.
But that is the great thing about stand-up. You are, the actual phrase is, you're only ever 6 months away from being brilliant again. And that is the absolute truth, that you kind of, we all get stuck in ruts. We all have stuff we've been doing for too long. But if you work at it, you can't be stopped. And it's such a lovely feeling, like, particularly in Edinburgh. Edinburgh's a really good context. If you know you've given everything, it doesn't matter, because you know in yourself that you've tried as hard as you could. You've tried as many ideas, and it also happens that, you know, the reviews are normally great because you've worked so hard at it. But it kind of doesn't matter if you get a bad one in a weird way, because you kind of go, well, you know. That's a two. It could easily have been a one, because this is me at my best, you know. But I think there's something odd about that you kind of, if you truly believe that you've given everything, it doesn't matter what someone says about you.
Does it make you as happy as doing, and call it jesters, or I think the first time I saw you in Edinburgh was in at the Upstairs, must have been 2006.
Yeah.
I remember crying with laughing at that show. I just thought, here is someone who, like, every second of this is funny.
Yeah, it was a really good show, that.
Does it give you as much pleasure to, or as much kind of positivity to do a show in front of 10,000 people as it does to do a show in front of 100 with a low ceiling?
It depends at what stage you're in. So if you have a bunch of new ideas and you do a 100-seater and they all work, and that's the best gig in the world.
Yeah.
But then if you're a little bit further down the line and you've got everything cooking and then you perform in front of 10,000 people and it just goes off, it's incredible as well, because you really feel the reward of all the work in that one night, because you say a joke, and then you can't be big enough. So particularly, you know, we're kind of similar performers, that in an arena you cannot be big enough, you cannot be more of a fool, you can't be more expressive, you can kind of go anywhere. Whereas in a 100-seater, I find them quite hard, because to kind of really perform, because people are like, all right, mate, fuck it, we get it. You know, you'd have to writhe around on the floor. You know what I mean?
Whereas, because your instinct is to be too big for the room.
Just because you just want to kind of go wherever. So if you're like, I had a bit ages ago about a thing about life could be worse, you could be a slug. You know, think about that. And I used to drag myself on the floor. It's like an old bit, you know, awful existence. You're just looking for lettuce. You can't even cry, because if you do, the tears will melt your face. So it's quite a nice little cute bit. But in a 100-seater, you kind of go, oh, but you would just say it. Whereas there's something quite nice about dragging yourself around the Apollo and performing it like that. So that's why I like the bigger gigs. From a performance point of view, but I really love doing small gigs to get ideas cooking. But I always sit down at those. I force myself to sit down, because otherwise I'll perform too big and it gets a bit weird. It's like,
well, is there a risk that you'll win the gig regardless of whether the stuff is good enough?
Exactly, yeah.
So you have to confine yourself. I think I heard about Chris Rock doing a thing where he just reads out the
Does he?
Jokes. Just reads out the jokes. Right. If they're funny, the jokes will work, because he knows he can perform.
Of course he can. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Yeah. I guess that he otherwise, because his performance is so preacher man and so big, that he can get anything across the line. Yeah.
So similarly, you have to chain yourself to a seat.
Yeah, and it also helps me think. I can think, like, I did loads of gigs recently at headliners in Chiswick, and I'm gonna, when I get back from America, I'm gonna do them every week again. With just a bunch of, you're welcome to come along, by the way. Like, it's just a bunch of people. The whole idea is it has to be new material, but it's really great because it's like 150 seater. It's quite a small stage. You can just sit on a stool and just vomit out ideas.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love those. I really enjoyed those gigs. But then once you've got them all cooking, it's really nice to perform big. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But then it'd be kind of interesting to see what it'd be like if you had the courage to try and create a set organically in arenas, but I don't think it would work. You know, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who also plays arenas, and he was sort of, we were both saying it's slightly frustrating that you do kind of creatively stand still once you embark on them, because you can't. It has to be a beginning, a middle, and end. It has to be in a monologue. You can't really talk with the front row because at the back they can't hear, and so you just have to make it this pulsating monologue, but it becomes kind of a bit boring for you because you have to do the same thing.
You are someone who, whether you write it all yourself or have help from a writer's room or whatever, you have to perform an enormous volume of material.
Yeah.
So when you're someone who started off kind of improvising, just making stuff up, do you find that there are certain loops that you find yourself in, or there are certain, like, I do that move quite a lot, or that voice quite a lot, or I take that approach quite a lot?
Not especially. No, I kind of... to use Good News as an example, I'll do... Like, I write the show with Steve Williams, Steve Hall, Dan Atkinson, and the last series we also had Lloyd Langford. Mm-hmm. So we all sit in a room and we write it together, complete, and everything kind of goes through me, but we write it, like, you know, I'm the front man of an amazing band. And then we come out and we go, right, these are the jokes. This is what we need. We're going to do this sketch. If somebody could do a cartoon of this, it'd be brilliant. And then we go to Sunday at Chiswick and we perform it. And I'll do anything to kind of make it work, because I feel like I represent the band.
Okay.
And I'm the singer and I'm the front man. So if Elvis needs to swing his hips, Elvis has got to swing his hips. So that's kind of how I feel. And I really love it for that. I really feel a sense of responsibility to make the jokes that I wrote, or that I wrote, you know, or that Steve Hall wrote, or Stevie Williams wrote, or Lloyd wrote. And we all do them together. And then I'm the privileged one that gets to perform them. But we all feel a sense of pride from it. You know, there's been so many things, particularly in the last series, that kind of, you know, the stuff about the junior doctors and... the tampon tax, and we did this thing about Philip Davies, who's a Tory MP that's kind of quite fond of filibustering. We did this whole thing about him. He was filibustering so that people couldn't discuss whether or not carers should get free parking for the disabled people they look after at hospitals, and he filibustered so that that could never take place. So we really went at him, and the Tories tried to sue us for defamation of character. And it's that great thing where you go, you know, it's what's really funny about it is that you're both kind of, it shows how little comedic work you've done. Where you go, we didn't make any of it up. Like he did all of it. So you're exposing like how little we did by just kind of going, well, he did do that. You know, and I mean, I said what he did in a slightly different voice, but he did it. So I've forgotten the question you asked me.
But this has led us down an interesting path, which is the idea of being the front man. Oh, no, look, we'll come back to that, because I wanted to talk about the anger, because these are quite political things, and like we wanted to really go for it.
Yeah.
Did that decision, given that you're the front man, and I think that's a really generous way of... No, I don't think it's really generous. I think you could easily not say that. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of people who work with writers who could easily say...
What's really interesting is... Yeah, but I mean, it's absolutely the truth that I kind of write... You know, I write everything. And so the way that Good News works is Thursday we go in, we do 10 till 6, and we kind of go through the papers, go through clips that have been found by all the researchers to work on the show. We write as many jokes as we can on each thing, try and turn it into something. Do exactly the same Friday, 10 to 6. Saturday, I'm on my own, and at home I go through the show that I want to put together all day. Normally takes me until like 7 o'clock, and then Sunday we have the morning off, and then we go into the office 1 till 4, kind of write on stuff that may have happened over the weekend. We then go to Chiswick, we do a warm-up show in front of a crowd, and then after that show we go through the notes, and we normally kind of get home about 11. We get in Monday, we go through all the mistakes we made and we fix things from the dry run. And then also, we kind of write new things that may have happened. Tuesday, we get in the morning, we film all the sketches we thought of. We do a dry run in the afternoon, and then we do the main show. And then I watch a paper edit of the main show on the Tuesday night, and then Wednesday morning I have off. And then Wednesday, I watch the proper edit of the show, and we carry on Thursday. So it's incredibly heavily authored. I sort of do everything, but I do it with so many brilliant people along the way. So the writing room is completely it's a beautiful meritocracy, because like there's been so many times where I've gone, that is funny, that you're all wrong.
Yeah.
and they've looked at me and went, it isn't. and I trust them, and they, you know, that's what's really brilliant about the writing room for Good News, is that you can have an idea and you go, that's funny, isn't it? And we kind of work it up, and it's great. And like, I might have an idea, and it kind of, you know, really works. And someone else adds a little line. But then also, you're in a great position where even though it's my show, somebody can go, that's a bit shit, let's not do that. Mm. And you go, oh, cool, great. Okay, fair enough. And it's a beautiful democracy that, you know, some weeks you kind of get like 20% of your stuff in, and then other weeks is 80%. You know, it's just that weird thing of...
And did it take time? Is that the original team that you started with? I know those people, and I know them to have been long-term friends of yours and great comics, great stand-ups in their own right. None of them are like professional... Obviously, I'll take that back. I don't mean they're not professional writers. I mean, none of them don't also do stand-up.
Absolutely. But then they don't do other shows. I think that's what's... probably different about Good News is that it isn't full of, you know, certain people that write on every show. So every show ends up sounding kind of similar. Whereas, you know, they're stand-ups who kind of work on Good News for X amount of time per year. That is the main team. Carl Minns used to do it, and then he stopped doing it. But apart from that, that's been the recurring team. You know.
So there's a huge amount of responsibility on your shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
There's like you're not just in terms of the being the person who has to make everyone's jokes work and your own as well, but like, you know, if Lloyd Langford's come up with an absolute banger and you murder it on the night. Do you know what I mean?
But that's the weird thing. Like I know I won't. That's my one skill, like, is I can kind of, and because I rewrite everything on Saturday. so it's in my voice. So even if it kind of if it may have started off as someone else's idea, then we kind of work with it in the room, and then I sit down and really look at it on my own.
Yeah.
On this, like, for example, the whole, we wrote a whole piece on Paris, and obviously Paris happened, you know, the Paris attacks happened on the Friday. So I wrote all of that on my own in the, on a Saturday. And then kind of took the ideas to the boys and said, this is where I think we should go. And then they massively improved my ideas. So, and then we, and then I performed them, but I kind of knew I could do it. You know, I always know I can, it's my, probably my only skill that I can kind of, I can get stuff over the line. Do you know what I mean? I kind of know how to perform to the camera and to people.
Does it have an effect on you? Like, kind of, I don't know, emotionally or mentally, knowing that you're the spearhead of the thing. Like, you're, you know what I mean? Like, you, there's a lot of people riding on you. If the really series gets cancelled, everyone loses those writing jobs.
Yeah.
You know, it, like, you've not only, it's not just like there's a regular pressure in being a comedian. You've got to be funny. If you're playing an arena, you've got to be, yeah, you absolutely have to be funny in front of everyone. And there's a lot of other subsidiary people. But specifically, and I suppose this would be just because of the nature of this podcast, I'm interested in the creative people who are relying on you for an income for series after series after series. Does that ever, do you ever feel like, oh man, it'd be good to take a break? I mean, you must be like emotionally exhausted, aren't you?
Well, it's a really fun job to do. And I can't think of anyone better to do it with. So I always, the time I spend in a writing room with those, like Steve Hall, you know, in particular, he's so funny. I mean, they all are, but like Hawley, there's a real side to Steve Hall, I think, that a lot of people haven't seen. Like, we call him Cruel, like Steve Cruel. That's his.
He's so
fucking vicious, and his stand up is great, but I'm always badgering him to kind of go, if you could release that your inner asshole. Like, he could rule, because he's so mean and so funny. But, you know, it's just, he's not interested in it. He just likes writing really great, accessible stand-up.
Do you think that he's not interested in it? Or do you think that he just hasn't managed to catch that thing in a way that you managed to catch your thing? You know, finding your voice or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You're, out of all of that group, they're all great comics. You're the one that had the massive success. I don't think that's, I mean, everyone's had success, but you're the one that went stratospheric. And is that simply luck that you managed to catch your thing? Or is it work ethic? Or what is it?
Well, I think it's a huge amount of luck and a lot of hard work. Like Mock the Week came along, and that was really massive for me.
Everything has to not just happen; it has to happen at the right time. Yeah, as well, right. Doesn't it?
Well, it was really interesting because it was kind of, you know, Mock the Week came along, and I was the young guy. I sort of was, you know, I didn't wear a suit, and I wasn't dressed in the same way, and I kind of looked a lot younger than everyone else, and had a different perspective. So I kind of just became, oh, he's the young guy.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of, that's very sort of two-dimensional. And then people would come and see you perform comedy, and you were so much better live than you could be on Mock, because you were learning how to perform comedy on TV next to people who were really amazing at it. So that was, and then once you first start doing it, things like Mock, You suddenly watch it back on TV and it's awful, because you're just kind of like, oh my God, look, you're all over the shop, you're gabbling. So you have to learn how to write for TV.
So what other things, that's a really interesting idea, watching yourself back and thinking, oh my God, we've all done that, I'm sure, in different contexts.
Yeah, well, especially when you don't have the edit and you're like, oh, here comes that really funny thing I said, son of a bitch!
Yeah.
And then you go, but I'll save that for live. So there's a lot of that going on.
So what other things were you learning in your first, when you watched the first series back?
Yeah.
That you were going, okay, I'm gabbling. What else? What other things did you want to fix?
I can't remember specifics. I just, like, being more economical and efficient with language. I think that's what, because it's a 28-minute show. So if you can go, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, It's going to be a lot better than you know, and it's kind of, so you have to kind of go, okay, I'm going to have to train myself to go one punch, two punch, three, one punch, two punch, three. So I kind of really, you start thinking about, okay, if we talk about this subject, what's the, how can I condense this? You know.
And do you think that made you better as a comic, or did it make you a more appropriate comic for that specific show?
I think it worked for that show. I don't think it necessarily works live, because live I just carried on doing what I was doing. But I think it definitely taught me a different approach to writing. So it was the first time I properly, when I started doing Mock the Week, that was the first time every week I would write on my own for 3 days a week. And that was brilliant for me, because it kind of it just trained myself how to kind of write. And you had a thing that you wrote for every week, and then you were competing against, I mean, you know, particularly Frankie was incredible.
Absolutely.
But particularly around then, he was really, like, he was the nation's darling. Everyone, like, even my uncle was like, that bloody Frankie Boyle, he just says some bloody terrible things, but he's incredible. People adored him, and, you know, still do. But so it was kind of that, it was a really, we had a real couple of years where it was really good. And I kind of felt like I was playing at the adults' table, playing catch-up, and kind of got there in the end.
Does your crowd need to come with you? Like, the challenge is there for you, as in to do tougher stuff, angrier stuff in your style.
Yeah.
Is there also a challenge whereby, and coming back to this thing of, like, how people see you, I think you're sort of, I think it's fair to say you are or were known as a kind of teeny bopper comedian.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? In that, like, you had, there's something about your style which is so warm. In the same way that, like, Milton, for example.
Yeah.
Milton's audience, a one-liner guy, but Milton's audience is very different to Gary Delaney's audience.
Yes.
You know, whereas, like, Tim Vine and Milton say, you can bring the kids.
Yes.
Because it's funny and delightful and frothy.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was something about your, the, what do I mean? The accessibility of your stuff, combined with the way that you were positioned in the marketplace as being like, this is the guy who you can bring your teenage children to.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think it was probably, it was something that I never planned, but I think probably on Mock the Week, the whole family would sit around. Mm-hmm. And maybe younger people were drawn to me because I represented them.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, but it wasn't something I deliberately sort of set out to kind of speak to the youth. And then doing a show on BBC Three, you know, it has a younger audience. But again, we never specifically thought, oh, what are young people into? Or anything like that.
Sure.
We kind of did a show.
Sure. And but if I'd been your management at the time, I'd have gone, hang on a minute. Do you know what I mean? This is going to work for a lot of... there's going to be people who've got disposable income.
Well, maybe they did. I mean, I certainly didn't. I never thought about that. I mean, there was, you know, there was talk of a calendar at one stage, which I, like, genuinely, I had my top off backstage at the O2, and, there was talk of a calendar, and I kind of just went, that's absolutely never happening.
And why? Why is that?
Because that would... Well, I've been asked to do, like, various things. I got asked to do, like, the... Head and Shoulders adverts, like before Joe Hart, like, and Jensen Button. I got asked to do those, and for a lot of money. And
given that you turned them down, can you tell us how much money they were offering?
£500,000.
Fuck me.
but how will I? How could I have gone on stage? Having done that, imagine that, seeing myself every...
Yeah, they're buying the rest of your career, aren't they?
Seeing myself on telly, I wouldn't be able to watch telly again, because I'd be watching a football game and really enjoying it, or I'd be watching, you know, a documentary. I'm really enjoying this. And then I would be washing my hair in front of me, and I would fucking cry. And then I go to gigs, and you go, hello, and Head and Shoulders would just bottles, be raining down. So, yeah, I could have really embraced it, but I chose not to. I'm just, and interesting, what's happened now is that I do, you know, I get quite a young audience, but I would say it's kind of oddly, it can be anywhere from like 14 to 60. It's really, and interesting, in the bigger gigs, you get a far greater spread yeah. than in smaller gigs. It was just like good news that we would get people from university and college. They'd rock up at 11 o'clock. Mm-hmm. They'd queue for the tickets. If you've got a job, you can't do that. So that was the thing. It became like a pilgrimage. People would, you know, kids would come, and that was their day. I mean, I'd have done the same if I was at college and we kind of had tickets. Well, let's just bunk off and go there. So I think that doing smaller gigs, they will get the tickets first.
Yes.
So oddly, and they would be very different gigs, doing a 200 in front of...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something quite nice about having a spread of people.
Yes,
kind of balance,
so they can't go too mental. I'm sure I saw Alex Zane do some stand-up. And it was like, you just couldn't even speak for the first 10 minutes. Because he was screaming but, girls. And you go, is that the same as a comedy audience?
But you wouldn't put me in that bracket, would you? Maybe I'm very sensitive to that because I've kind of like, but you have a similar
to
thing
Alex Zane, I should say as well.
No,
he's a comic, and you know,
absolutely fine. and but Alex, you know, Alex is a TV presenter who does comedy, I would say, but you kind of, it's all that weird thing, isn't it, of like, I mean, you're the same, we both have certain faces. Like, we could have been...
I mean, neither of us are Jimmy McGee.
But we could both have been... We could have been the songwriters in a boy band. Like, you know, like, we couldn't have been...
We couldn't have been the lead.
Not the lead, but you'd have come up with...
We'd have made the money.
You'd have done the dance moves, and we'd have written the songs together, and we'd have given them to whoever was the front man. So, but we have, you know, we have kind of... And there's not a lot you can do about that.
I reflect on this often, given that it's hard to talk about without sounding like an absolute arsehole.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, good job that I chose the single profession where it is not useful to look like you could have written the songs in a boy band.
Absolutely, yeah. But you kind of, I don't know.
So what are we talking about?
I don't know what we're talking about. You're attracting a young audience. Yeah, so I'm at pains to... emphasize that I didn't go out of my way, and I don't know why that kind of irks me, but like, I don't know, like, but it's like the idea that I kind of was like, obviously I'm incredibly lucky, I'm definitely that is the case, but I've really worked hard to be better, and I haven't kept the same 20 minutes that a lot of people that might quibble about me have.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. It's one of the differences. You go, well, you know, there's a reason that you're all still here, because you've got the same 20 minutes you've been doing forever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I suppose to describe you as I can understand that's why you might be sensitive to that, because it does seem to ignore all of the fucking hard work.
Well, it was just it's it's the idea that there was a little thing that was going around a little while ago, the whole like, oh, you know, like, as a, again, it's the common room cunt criticism would be, oh, you know, such and such has got E4 hair. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
that was
okay,
the sort of thing going around. But just the idea that, like, English audiences are tough. Like, I've gigged all over the world. English audiences are, like, fucking tough. The very idea that you could walk in front of them, waggle your hair, and they would go, this guy.
Having said that, do you recognise your influence in other younger comics, given that you are someone who probably launched a lot of, probably inspired a lot of comics, I would imagine that you, a lot of young comics,
right?
I would imagine that 10 years ago, or whenever you, 8 years ago, whenever you started doing Good News, then went on to become BBC Three's favourite show, that kind of won a recognition for that. So there's a huge number of young people watching that who were probably, you are the first comic they saw.
Yeah. But also, maybe it's that, like, a very ordinary looking little bloke that you would kind of look at him and go, oh, I could be him, in a similar way that I looked at Lee Evans, who is a very beta male, brilliantly funny stand up, and I looked at him at 15 going, fuck, that's
I can be
funny like that. Yeah. I can, because. Yeah, because I don't look perfect, I don't have, you know, like, it's sort of that interesting thing, isn't it? I think a lot of people up, and maybe this is where I may have had an influence, but again, I sound like a dick for saying that, but or someone like Josie Long may have had a lot of influence.
100%.
Because, I think Josie, I remember watching Josie at Edinburgh a couple of years ago, and it was fucking great because, and I remember looking at her thinking, it must be really so great because she's such a vulnerable, sweet girl who's really funny, who isn't having, she isn't being a man, she isn't having to change herself to survive in this world, she's being exactly who she is, and you would find that, I think if you were a young girl, you'd find that incredibly inspiring, or someone like Roisin Conaty or Kerry Godleman, you'd sort of see them and you go, like Kerry Godleman, I saw her the other day, fuck me, what a comedian, she's unbelievable, like she's genuinely one of the best sets I've seen in years. It was fucking wonderful. But you would look at her, and my auntie, my cousin Claire could be her. Like, my cousin Claire is really funny, really funny. And I've often sort of said, you should do stand-up. But she might look at Kerry Godleman and go, that could be, I could do, you know. So maybe I might have done that in a way that being a bit of an oik in the corner on a show, occasionally saying something quite funny, you go, oh yeah, I could, yeah,
absolutely,
you know. And I think if I've done anything, I might have done that.
Absolutely. I think even more so than that, the influence of you as a front runner of people doing anecdotal stuff rather than jokes, or anecdotal stuff which is the jokes.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? What we've been discussing previously about your style.
Yeah.
You are someone who, I think a lot of young male comics have gone, I can talk about my friends. I can talk about my friends' lives.
Yeah, I don't know though, but because I'm certainly not the first person to have done that. Like, that's kind of all Connolly did, or that's all.
Yeah, but he wasn't a young guy that looked a bit like you.
Okay, I see.
Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of comics might go, "Oh, right." It's almost like you could be identified as, maybe you didn't come into it like this. When I came into comedy, I felt like, and the last, to a certain extent, the last 10 years have been an attempt to get out of this mindset.
Right.
I felt like there was a way you did comedy. I feel like, there's a way you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, if we're honest, I think probably a lot of us started with that, and a lot of people are starting now with that idea. But there is a way that you do comedy.
Hold whatever thought you have in your head, because I have a question for you. Does this not mess you up? Because I think if I interviewed and I spent time with loads of great comedians, and they were, and what always strikes, because I listen to this, and what strikes me is some people are very, very definite, and I really like it. Like, I really love the episode with John Gordillo. I fucking love that. I really love it. But I don't know. I'd love to be he knows exactly how to do it. My question to you is, has that fucked you up? Because you must have thought, or have you learned through assimilation of all the ideas?
Sure. It's a good question, and the answer is the opposite. The answer is neither. It hasn't fucked me up, nor have I managed to assimilate everyone's things.
Yeah.
What it has done is it's made me realise that thing I just said, which is that, oh, the whole way I was doing comedy, I was thinking there was a way to do it.
Yes.
And doing all of these interviews has made me realise, oh, God, there isn't. I've been barking up the wrong tree. There is no way to do it.
Yes.
And so when I first started doing these podcasts, these interviews, it was because I felt like I wanted the best people in the world to train me up.
Right.
Because I thought, well, they've worked out the secret.
Yes.
Obviously, now I've done over 150, 160 of them. I've realised that, no, everyone takes their own path, discovers their own rules, and so it's therefore perfectly fine for me to identify that it isn't like how I thought it was, and actually far more useful than that. It's been such, you know, I can never sum this up in an interview when I'm doing a 10-minute Q&A for a tour. In many ways, it has, in all sorts of ways, it's made me realise that I don't need to do that. That I don't need to try and take everything on board.
Because
actually, I'm interested in people's own. I hate using the word journey, but that's what it is. I'm interested in people's own journeys for the sake of those people. For me, the question isn't really how do you write your jokes. The question is how do you get happy.
Right.
Are you happy? How do you become happy? And can I learn from that? And or can I help?
Okay, I see.
Which is why it always turns into therapy. Because actually,
I really hope if there's people listening, but in between, we've had two piss breaks and two tea breaks, and I'm very nervous because I feel like it's got quite deep. So I really hope we're not boring the shit out of you. But I'm really sorry if we are.
I'm cutting that.
No, not me. Because but it's really.
This is why people listen, and it's the main reason.
But are you happy?
Yeah, more so than ever.
Good.
More so than ever. Am I completely free of having little wiggly breakdown tearful moments at my partner and then looking at my son and thinking, God, he's seeing his dad cry? Am I free from that? No, I'm not.
Right.
But am I coping with those moments better than ever? Yeah.
Good. That's amazing. No. But I remember my dad said this to me when I was 14. We were like in his car and he went, "Trouble you, son, you'll never be happy." And that's the way it is. And he was like, because I'm so much like my dad, I'm my dad's son, and I am driven completely by fear, and I'm so loath to fix that because then I think, then I won't be me and I won't be funny and I won't be able to do the things. So obviously I have moments of utter joy and I'm incredibly lucky to get to do loads and loads of cool things, but it's all driven by fear. Like I've never, like you don't come off stage at the O2 going, "Nailed it." You come off stage at the O2 going, "Fucking hell, is that right? Whew, fuck, felt good. Was good. Felt good. Yeah. Whoa, cool. That was good, wasn't it? Yeah. And then you take half an hour to kind of, you know, kind of come down, but I have to have fear. And interesting, I read about Johnny Wilkinson is a fantastic person. You should try and get him on this if you could, to talk about this, because I don't know a lot about rugby, but when he kicked the goal,
conversion.
It wasn't a conversion.
No,
I think it was a
try. I don't know the words. Yeah. This is the blind leading the blind.
When he did the magic kick and won the World Cup, he won the World Cup. There was a thing in his brain that went, he nearly missed that. And the next day he was out training again to practice. And I just really recognised that. That really spoke to me, that kind of thing of going, that to answer your question about the happiness, is that I will always have something in my brain going, yeah, but, fucking, but, you know, because nothing's ever perfect. You'll never get anything right. So you're always striving to make your equivalent of like Arizona Bay or something like that that's so, so perfect, but you'll never reach it. That's the sadness. That's kind of what I'm figuring out. And we're all going to die.
My best mate said something to me very similar to what you were saying about your dad. He was reading, your dad saying, "Problem is, you'll never be happy."
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, is your dad happy?
Well, no, but well, actually, yeah, my dad is, but no one around him is. But he is blissfully unaware. Like, okay. he's really, yeah, he's really great, my dad. And very, very...
he's really great, did you say?
Great, and yeah, really driven, and really, has been... It's kind of interesting, because my mum gets a lot of praise, and rightly so, because she's an incredible woman, and really funny, and raised us with a real sense of zest and joy and silliness. But my dad has like iron will, like nobody. Like there's nothing. My dad, if he sets out to do something, he will achieve it. And he's kind of passed that down to me and my sister. My little brother, not so much. But and so I'm really grateful for him, for the way, in terms of the way that he taught us to be, kind of to try, you know, really, really hard. My dad's work ethic is insane, insane.
I brought myself to comedy, I now realise, after therapy and these.
Yeah.
I think I brought myself to comedy because I wanted to make everything all right. I wanted to make there be no awkwardness.
Right.
Didn't want there to be any awkwardness at the dinner table.
Oh, okay.
So I grew into someone who always had something to say,
right,
who could always make everyone laugh.
Wow.
Right? So there wouldn't be any awkwardness.
Wow.
And I...
So you talk about me earlier, about pressure. Like, that's pressure, isn't it? fuck, I mean, I've never felt pressure like that to kind of sit down, have dinner. Presumably you're a kid at this stage. How old are you?
Yeah. Sitting there as a kid. And it's not like everything was always horrible at all. It's not like everything was horrible. I had a really nice upbringing. But the decisions I made about it, I went, I can't be... I think that person's a bit angry at that person. I've got to fix this. Because unless everything's totally blissful, it's not good enough. I've got to fix this. I've got to be the glue.
Shit.
Right? And I don't want to paint my childhood as anything other than this sort of idyllic...
No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that the fact that your brain imposes that upon you is... that is tiring, isn't it? That's responsibility.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
But like, I only had that later on. But like, to have that is like, I feel that, you know, like, it's like, even this now, this is why I'm so nervous about it, because I'm sort of aware that I haven't been particularly funny in it. So I'm kind of nervous because my job is to be funny.
Yeah, you're not.
No, but that's what I'm saying.
You're paid for this. But
this is what I'm saying. There is still, I'm really enjoying this, and I'm finding it quite scary, and it's quite a revealing, weird interview to do, but there is part of my brain going, yeah, I've been very funny for a while there. That's what I'm getting at. I'm 36, but to have that when you're 8, you know what I mean? Like, come on, Stuart, Jesus, your dad's eating the peas slowly. Like, fuck me, that must have been just...
It's pretty knackering. The reason I mention it is because I wondered if you might be a bit like me. It's interesting hearing you talk about that work ethic, because I had a bit of a pet theory that I'm happy to have blown out of the water.
Okay.
That someone who has spent as many man hours as you have telling us all how great your family is and how much fun they all are and how they all get along.
Yeah.
I wondered if that might come from a similar place of wanting that to be the case.
Well, there's certainly times when that has been the case. Like, it hasn't always been perfect. Like, when I was a kid, wasn't always perfect. But now, like, weirdly, my success has really brought my family together, and it's amazing. And so they all come to watch me do stand up. They all really love it, and we all get to do. We all went to Australia for a month that I paid for because of comedy. So it's been an amazing thing. And it's kind of like, I come from a really normal background. So for my mum to see her son on stage telling jokes about her is fucking mind blowing. And I'm very aware of how kind of lucky I am to be able to do that and to kind of make her feel good. Like, no one likes my stuff more than my mum. Like, I tell you what, she's a big fan. So yeah, definitely there's, you know, but there was times like when I was younger where not you know, the same as any family life, not everything's perfect, but I never wanted to kind of fix the family. I kind of went away from my family. I didn't really spend a huge amount of time with them from my sort of early 20s, well, from university till about 25, didn't really see a lot. I was just gigging. I was off doing my thing. I was kind of the lost sheep and just doing stand-up. And then oddly, they kind of came to me, and we're all now really like super close in a way that we kind of weren't for quite a long time. But I think that's natural, isn't it? When you're you go through that phase when you're a sort of late teenager of just kind of like, I really like hated my dad. Everyone does, you know. Yeah, God. And now I love him, and but I think that's not to do with comedy. I think that's just getting older and seeing what he did. And yes,
so you're the front man for your family as I was blithely an hour ago talking about that must be a lot of pressure having Steve Hall's writing job, you know, for this show riding on you. And actually, is that part of the work ethic? Like, this has to be funny because
my family is
fucking bringing the family back together.
No. I feel no pressure. The only pressure I feel is that my nan has like a wall that's got every poster or every clipping she's ever seen of me.
She's got the calendar.
She would have the calendar, but honestly, mate, this is just this wall, huge wall of all. So she cuts stuff out that she'll see in the papers, including like we got one really terrible review for a film we did at Christmas, and it's up on the wall. She just asked it. It's like, it generally says, it's from the Bristol Evening Post. It goes, Russell Howard's Christmas comedy got it horribly wrong. And it's smack in the middle of like, the wall. So the only pressure I feel is, you know, that reviews have to be good enough. Otherwise, I'm going to be looking at them on my nan's kitchen door. Yeah.
So that was Russell. All of the extras available at comedianscomedian.com/extras once you have joined the mailing list via a small, slightly frustrating, but ultimately successful process. Thank you to Russell. Thanks to Johnny Mouncer for editing and uploading the show. James Hingley for his help online with web development and so forth. And Emily Crosby for her superb logging of what was an extremely long, long interview. Thank you for listening. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for sharing in the sense of actually actively sharing it with your friends. Thanks for your reviews on iTunes and your money. Very kind of you. That's all for now. Coming up next week, I guess next week might well be Shappy Call Sandy. I'm very excited about that episode, and there's lots more goodies coming up soon too. I'll speak to you soon. Thanks for sticking around for this bit. If you have, I will now chat to you about how tired I am. And also, hey, I tell you, before I do that, the most important thing I wanted to say is thank you everyone that got in touch about the slightly oblique reference I made in last week's episode to finding myself getting a bit cross with my baby. I'm really happy to report this very much the exception rather than the rule. And even when I was talking about, like, I referred to something in the Liam episode, and that was weeks ago, and when I talked to Liam about it, it was something that had happened weeks before that, so please don't think I've got any kind of ongoing problem with this. I think it's just one of those elements of parenthood that kind of blindsides you. And I want to make clear as well, a particular listener got in touch, someone who I'm in very frequent contact with and has listened to every episode. And I suppose with these bits that I now cannot help calling the waffle, because that's what I think that's what you called them, I am learning what these bits are. And one of the things that they are, one of the things they're not, is just a sort of personal diary into which I share my innermost thoughts, although there's elements of that. And one of the things that they are I only really tell you about things I'm struggling with. So please don't think that I am having a tougher time being a dad than I am. I bloody love it. So I thought to give balance, I'd tell you about the time when I took the Boutros swimming. I take him swimming every week, me and Pete Dobbing, who's a friend and confidant of this show, a big part of we have regular blue sky thinking meetings about the show as to where it might go next, where it should be going next. Pete and I live near each other. We have babies of similar ages, and on a Wednesday afternoon we take our babies swimming. This was not one of those occasions, although that most recent one was a lot of fun as well, but I took the boy swimming on my own and balanced inside a couple of pool noodles and had him in the little baby safe. You know, we've had some lessons. The baby safe swimming. He doesn't swim. He barely kicks. He just looks around going, okay, there's more stuff to look at. I feel different, not in a way I can comprehend. And it's so funny to refer to it as going swimming with him. Acclimatizing the Boutros to a water-based environment. And so I'm kind of got these two pool noodles curved under my arms to keep me afloat as I'm holding him. And I'm just kind of kicking my legs and he's looking around. And I was just sort of gently singing to him. And it occurred to me I was probably the happiest I've ever been. No, I mean, I've been happy in lots of different environments before. And, you know, definitely the day I proposed was also very, very happy indeed. But there's other sort of life highlights thing. This felt like serene. Not the most happy I've ever been. The most serene. God, it's lovely. Floating underneath your baby. That's pretty great. So, but you see my point. There's nothing funny about that. There's nothing, you know, no one wants to come and see an hour or hear a recording of all the great things. I mean, maybe they are. I mean, it's funny that this should come up at this episode, because obviously with Russell Howard's good news, that was the angle, the pitch of that show was, hey, let's have some positive news. What I use these bits for is an opportunity to talk about things with which I'm struggling. So I just think it's important to me that you know that, because I was slightly taken aback by a couple of listeners who got in touch in a kind of a... So a few people got in touch in a very positive, friendly way, but it made me go, oh, Jesus, I probably came across like I was really struggling there.
And although parenthood is, take my word for it, a struggle, it is not a permanent, perpetual or unbeatable struggle. In my case, I'm pleased to say, and I hope it remains so. So I felt simultaneously cherished by you guys who got in touch, and also I felt as if I should point out that I'm totally fine, guys. I mean, sometimes I was making too much of a fuss about something small, because you know, I've done that before. I've talked sometimes about getting annoyed with people on Facebook, and then people send me nice messages going, yeah, don't worry about Facebook. I'm like, no, I'm not worrying about it. I'm just in front of you now, trying to work through it, trying to sort of I don't know. Trying to let you in a bit more on my life. I try to stay out of my interviews, as you know. I think that's my secret weapon in podcasting. I try not to speak. That's making me fairly unique in the world of podcasting. I try not to feature. These bits are partly an attempt to get to know you a bit better, let you get to know me a bit better. And also, they're partly an attempt to just kind of work out some problems out loud. One of the methods that I use when I'm writing stand-up is to pace around a room talking out loud, but you just feel such a burk doing it that actually this, knowing that people are going to listen to it, is sort of a different approach. So anyway, thanks to everyone that got in touch, and don't worry, I'm totally fine. The Boutros is fine. The Boutros' mama is totally fine. And we're doing well. On another note entirely, I mentioned the other week this preview I'd had, and I said something about it on Facebook, and everyone sort of piled in a very supportive way. I have, you'll be relieved to know, had several much better previews since then. And one, I turned up to the venue, it was double booked, and Harriet Kemsley very kindly split the double booked preview with me. We did half an hour each. And I walked away from doing a half hour, like imagining I had to do an hour, and then, oh, I've only got to do half an hour. Oh, I can just do all the fun, silly bits that don't quite work yet, but I feel have potential. Well, wasn't that way more useful than walking on stage, trying to hold an entire hour in your head and thinking, I don't even know if I can remember that bit that goes to that bit. What's the connections? I did a preview with Amy Halverska at the Ethicurian, which is an incredible restaurant, an incredible, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, the word posh doesn't sum it up, nor indeed does... I don't know how to sum it up. Hip, posh and hip. It's a posh hip restaurant, that's what it is. I don't know, I don't have the words for that. I'm not a specialist. But we had some very nice food, and we did a couple of previews in there. And I came off, and Amy Halverska, wonderful comic and friend, gave me possibly the best stand-up comedy note it is possible to give someone. She said, yeah, just do the funny bits. Now, that's... I mean, it's great. I love it. Really made me happy. Because I think I had sort of nudged her towards saying that, because I came off thinking, do you know what? All of the bits that are jokes and silly, where I get to enliven them and play around in them, and this might just be for the way I work, they were really strong. And all the bits where I had to read off a card, the link that I was making between one bit and another, they weren't funny. Why not just do the funny bits? Remember that brilliant podcast question that when I appeared on Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, and we had a little jokey play with the concept that that the best question that's ever been asked on his show was actually asked by a child, when a child said to Stephen Fry, who's a guest on the show, what's it like being Stephen Fry? Well, in much the same way as that is, I believe, you know, what's it like being you? That's the only question, isn't it? That's what I'd try and do with this show. How do you write? How do you really write? How do you cope? How do you really cope? That's my remit, I think. And all of that really is, what's it like being you? In a similar way, I mean, maybe you should just do the funny bits. That's kind of the only thing that needs to be said about stand-up, isn't it? You can... Jesus, the amount of time and effort and compression that goes into writing an hour, for me, certainly. I'm not a sit-down-and-bash-it-out-in-2-weeks guy. Who is? But the amount of compression of thought that goes into an hour is incredible, when really... Sometimes you see it as like, oh God, I'm busy. I'm halfway through cracking a safe, and I've got to take the entire structure out, all the metal bits and the balls and the hoops and everything, and I've got to carry it and hold it in the right order and present it to an audience. And you think, no, you don't need to do that at all. You need to turn up and talk to some humans for an hour, and that's all you need to do. Just be funny. Just do the funny bits.
That'll do for now. I'm so tired. I am going to safely drive home, mostly because I want to stay alive, but partly because it would be too ironic if this were the drive that did for me. Oh, that's tense. Don't worry. We won't upload this episode until I'm safely home. Look after yourselves. Take care of yourselves. Drive safely. Get enough sleep. Look after your babies. Don't get angry. Life's too short. Speak to you soon.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.